This RFM podcast was brought to you with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Steve, it's 12 noon and the final edition of Book Lovers Why Rapper.
Yes, we've taken a little liberty, haven't we, because we're not at 3.30 on the fourth Tuesday. That being Christmas Eve seemed a bit challenging.
And we do appreciate you, Steve, taking time off from your council works and meetings, which I presume are, you know, it's actually Christmas party time and entertaining the troops. But
no council meetings this week.
Right. I'm Gareth Rapson with co-host Steve Lawrence, and this is your one-hour program, your final for the year, by the way, about the wonderful world of books. You can find us on 92.7 Arrow FM and on Channel 41 of Wairapa Freeview Television. Now, Steve, I haven't, from the latest grapevine,
yep,
the 13th and 14th seasons of Wairapa Word. I did not know it went that long.
Well, 2012, yeah, so 12 years. Anyway, I'm not quite sure how it would be 13th and 14th, but
I know, and there's a absolutely wonderful photo here with Marilyn Garson,
yes,
holding some magnificent peonies.
From our garden. Well, Debbie's garden, to be honest.
Let's give Debbie all the credit, but a great photo.
Yeah, and just a nice little Wairarapa sort of flower, because they grow better here than they do in Wellington.
They do. We have peonies. Mm. Big year for Wairarapa Word.
Yeah, just briefly, just run through things and I'll give you a quick comment.
Okay, we started the season with Peter Stevenson.
He's Welsh. He's been here a couple of times. I think he came and stayed with Gay Sutton up our way.
He's the folk tale?
Yeah, so he's had a couple of books of folk tales published. But folk tales are the spoken form, really, a bit like poetry.
Does he sing?
I don't know.
Well, she might have. You know, like, it's kind of like I expect that to sort of
Land of Our Fathers and stuff. I don't think there was any of that.
Men of Harlech.
Yeah.
Very
engaging. Lots of kids came.
Right. And then Charlotte Squire?
Yeah, that was only a workshop and it was done remotely because she's from Nelson.
Okay.
So that was about, if you want to write down a family history, how you go about that. And
right.
It's quite a lot of interest.
Because oral histories are very, very topical in this valley. There are people there's a lot of stories and a lot of people collecting them. Mike Joy.
Yes.
Now, his fight for fresh water.
Yes. Very well attended. We sold a lot of books. We pre-sold a lot of books because the book hadn't actually been published at that stage.
That worked. And Julia Marshall came in from Gecko Press, which I'm starting to see a few of their books.
She's actually sold the business. So she built it up. She built it up originally by picking up European books published in other languages, getting them translated and then published here, published in English. That was the basis of what she did, but she's also done a number of New Zealand titles since.
And then Catherine J. Adams burst on the scene. Rainbow Fantasy? How did that go?
Well, it went pretty well. It was well attended, ran a good workshop.
She was about how to work with a literary agent.
Yeah.
How did that? That is an interesting topic in itself. Who are these literary agents?
Oh, they're around, and they are the ones who know how to get your publication in front of an editor at a publisher. So that one was picked up by Hachette, I think.
So if I bought my little novel in the bottom, you know, shelf out, I'd find a literary agent, and they were on their way.
If you could find one who was prepared to read it and then was prepared to risk their reputation telling someone that it was good, I think that's how they do it.
Yeah, actually, I don't think I'd get past square one. The winter came. Then James Hollings.
Yes.
He was the deep murderous past.
Well, he's a journalist, really, a professor of journalism at Massey. So that book was as much about journalism as it was about the crew murders, but it just happened to be how we'd put it together. And he really was, he did it in association with one of his students, I suppose you'd say, who did quite a lot of the legwork and
there it goes.
Put it together.
Then we had our very own Rhonda Grigg and Madeline Slavak.
Yep.
Publisher of Town recently.
And Rhonda's new book as well. They're both very nice little packages. Very nice pieces of publishing.
Sarah moderated it. How did that go? McClintock, was it, from Aratoy?
Yeah, good. I think we made a tactical error. We had the heating on and we had her sitting over the top of the heater because it goes underfloor.
These are the stories you want to hear on you know, Book Lovers Corners, of course. Janet Frame's birthday.
Yep. So we know about that because you and I starred.
We did. We read.
As did
100 others. The I thought that was a stunning thing, actually, to do.
Bit of a tragedy in the way that the, we can say this here because no one's listening, the way the Janet Frame Trust have dealt with it, because we've recorded all these things. Michael did it professionally with good gear, edited out all the, you know,
all the ums and ahs. Yeah.
But there, and we've sent a copy to the trust, so they have a copy, but it doesn't exist anywhere else. So. I thought it was very handy.
Our dulcet voices are lost.
Well,
for the
unless they choose to do something right at some point.
Nothing is really ever lost. Ra Smith burst onto the scene in September.
Yep.
And that was about...
The connection to why we was around Maori stories about the freshwater and the Wairarapa, but...
That kind of was picked up again by Diana Grant with her South of Martinborough.
Yeah, her and Leslie Simmons, who is a Masterton writer. She's written an enormous work. Leslie's American, and she's written an enormous work about the Cherokee Indians.
And of course, our local historian Gareth Winter. What was he like?
Oh, Gareth's good. He's very engaging, as you know.
I don't think I've ever, for my sins, because I've seen his books, his little publications.
You must be the only person in the Wairarapa who doesn't meet him. He's what's a good word? Ubiquitous.
He's one of the many gaps. But and the season ended with Marilyn Garson with the peonies.
Well, it was really a book about Jewish, not Zionist.
How did that go? Because that was slightly, well, as... The potential audience could have been a bit...
Well, we were a little bit nervous. When she... She bought a book from me and online and I said, you know, g'day, how are you? Because, you know, I knew who she was. And then she said, oh, I'm getting a new book and it's out soon. And I said, well, nobody knows anything about this. And she said, you know, we were keeping it a bit quiet just in case. So they were probably aware of
pushback.
Yeah. And we were slightly nervous because it's, you know, we're kind of booky people, not activists as such. But in the end, there was a good crowd and it was a different crowd. And it's one of the things we like in Why Word. I mean, we did a thing with... Professor Lester from Victoria, who's all about all the things that'll kill your bees, and so all the beekeepers in the valley turned up, and we like that, provide a variety and get a different group of people along, and there were definitely different people there.
And for Marilyn's, you know, she was good with taking questions. Were there any tricky questions from the floor?
No tricky ones. I had some tricky ones, but I didn't want to ask her.
Flags? Anyone bring flags?
No.
Because I see them out in the street.
Yeah.
On the square.
I thought everybody would have their black and white scarves and shawls and things on, but they didn't.
All right. Hey, overall, the big picture, it looks, congratulations, because it's a terrific year program, and there's a lot of work. The work goes in, is it Madeline or who, you?
I kind of help with the admin. It's slightly tricky. Wairarapa Word doesn't actually exist. It isn't anything. It's not an incorporated society. It's not a, which makes it a bit challenging for it to get a bank account. It needs a bank account. So I run it through a suffix of my business bank account.
Well, on your 13th season, you know, well done. And
we have a committee of five or six people, I guess.
And you would carry, I know these books are available in the library service, but you would also be supporting them through Elmos.
Yeah, I generally source the books and take them along to the events and make some sales. Mm. It's not, you know. It's not a business, but it's just it's one of the things we can offer the writers.
Yeah, no, I just think it's wonderful support.
A bit of support.
Yeah. Anyway, and for the updates on the 2025 program in the 14th season, which visit the Wairarapa Word Facebook page or send sign me up email to events@gmail.com.
Yeah.
All right, and get your news in your little mailbox.
Well, we're working on next year's program, so we've got February and March sorted out. February, I think I said last time at that stage, a bit brave because I hadn't told anybody else. Simon Burt, who's from Masterton, has written a book about the back road to Pongaroa, Highway 52, I think it is.
Tell me about the audience of that when it's done. That'll be good.
Well, I think it's stories about that part of the Wairarapa, really.
It's about yarns and barns type of that sort of stuff. But if he's got a good yarn to tell, it'll go.
And I think he's going to get Carl Dufresne to come along and chat as well, because Carl's from up that way. And he may even bring his guitar.
Excellent.
So that's why we're...
Excellent. And we look forward to 2025. Now, moving on to books. I have several books I've read, and then I called by Elmos to get Madeline to give me a pile of them so I could bring them here and show them, and they're all sold out. So give us a little overview. What is really moving in Elmos at the moment?
What's really moving? Well...
Lee Charles, is he going?
Yeah, in terms of actual numbers, that's probably our biggest selling book, I guess, because people just, you know, the one comes out every November and everybody buys one for Christmas.
Right.
And they do it every year.
I know, and I look forward to getting the next one somewhere. Well, it'll
be the same as the last one.
It will be, but it's kind of like a family thing, in it. You know, we kind of like, our family likes talking about them. I noticed in the bookshop your stack of Nagi is slowly going down, Nagi Maharshi's dinner.
And we got some more because we got the heads up from Macmillan that unless we got some more, then there wouldn't be any more until January sometime. Mm. So.
And there's many years between each book, so it's, you know, there's hopefully they'll go because I'm such a fan.
I'm not worried.
And then I tried to get Precipice by Robert Harris.
Yes.
Gone.
Yeah, we had some yesterday, so she must have sold some today.
Right. I've got a little bit here in my little notes on Precipice. I did like, you know, kind of Act of Oblivion and V2 and Munich and Conclave. You know, he's a proven sort of high-standard historical setting writer. And you know, he weaves fact and fiction, you know, as good as anyone.
Yeah, which is kind of what you need to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're just writing fact, then it gets a bit dry.
Yeah, and this plunges us in Precipice, plunges us into the days before World War One, and it's a story of letters. Now that's where my first little issue with this book comes up. One half of the correspondence existed. His side were kept, 560 letters, which 3,000 words. I mean, the man was besotted and absolutely...
And he wrote down some stuff he ought not have.
Yeah, I know. And then Harris provides her responses and all that.
Mm.
And this affair kind of ended the last Liberal government that...
Britain was to have, and after that it was all
Tories
and a little bit of Labour. Mm. But it's the story of the English elites, you know, Asquith and the King and aristocrats and cabinet ministers, and of which Churchill was in amongst there. And it's the research, as always, is impressive. And the characters are good. Lot of historical events. Of course, the ones that we'd be interested in was how Gallipoli played out and in the cabinet room. That was everybody would enjoy that. Behind the scenes, it's interesting, but my little quibble is it's not thrilling. You know, like it's engaging. I enjoyed it, but the suspense of creating an MI6 sort of agent who is trying to track out what's happening to the letters and is inveigling into the life of her and arresting the odd German resident who, you know, it's we're used to a bit more high octane, you know, Black Doves, Day of the Jackal kind of stuff, and what do we get is a more lettery type of thing. And correspondence sometimes, you know, Harris does his best, but for me it wasn't what I would call, it wasn't exciting enough. So for fans of Robert Harris, fine. And I'm glad that it's selling well. All right, that'll just move that one off. Mm. The next book I tried to get was Stephen Fry's Odyssey.
Yes, now I'm getting some more of that, so that should turn up very soon.
My neighbours went and saw him the other day in the St. James Theatre, Wellington.
Uh-huh.
And he then told them how he had never performed in Wellington. He'd been to Australia on his tour, you know, talking tours and all that, and had been in Wellington a lot with Lord of the Rings.
Yes, of course he was.
But this was his first episode. And so, like, he spoke for 3 hours for $180 you could attend and I met two sets of people who went, and they said, stunning.
Mm.
They said a genius type guy.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And just so entertaining. And he was pitching Odyssey, but basically talking about his life in Wellington when he was here, because that's the audience. They said he seemed to be able to talk about anything in the most interesting, erudite way. And second half, he came out with one of his magnificent ties.
Because he's got a book about ties. Prize ties.
But, you know, as a raconteur, you know, they said, you know, just money, just was fantastic. Anyway, Odyssey, which I, Can You Find a Way Home? You know, the great story. What do you think of the cover of Odyssey, which we haven't got here to show you, but it is a stylized of the day boat plunging down.
It's blue and white, isn't
blue
it?
Blue and white. Your thoughts?
No, that's good.
Oh, good. It's fantastic.
Well, I judge them, you know, I judge them on the basis that you can find them in a bookshop.
Right.
And
well, that's often challenging with your vast range, but
well, it is, but also,
but it's beautifully alphabetized.
Covers go. There are trends, and you've got this book talk thing, which has generated all these kind of romancy type things, and the covers are all the bloody same. They're all pastels and sort of almost comic-y drawings of attractive people, and if I'm looking for one of those, I've got no chance. They're all this.
But, I mean, let's just tick it off. Like, he's a comedian.
Yes.
He's an actor. He's a presenter on television. He's an author.
Mm. I don't think he sings.
No. He was in Blackadder, wasn't he? Wasn't he? General Mickhoff or something or other. He was a general in that.
Started off with a little bit of Fry and Laurie.
Right.
Hugh Laurie. I think, and that, I don't know, was it Oxford or Cambridge and the reviews, you know, with the footlights or whatever they called it.
How did your classical education go?
My classical education?
Yes.
Classic comics.
No, like our knowledge of, you know, Greek heroes and myths, like, you know.
Well, I've seen Troy.
I've seen Troy. Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
All right, Killing people, Paris. Yes,
on front. People were a bit mean. I thought that was a pretty good movie.
I thought it was stunning. But
we did not have a classics teacher at Inglewood High School.
And I didn't do Latin, so this stuff just all flew Greek. By me. So this is Stephen Fry's great gift, of course, to the world, is for all of us who didn't get an Oxford classical education.
Mythos, Troy, Odyssey. Is there another one?
Yeah, it
goes, certainly those three.
Yeah, Mythos, Hero.
Yeah.
Troy, Odyssey.
Yeah.
If you read that, you have an Oxford classical thing. And you are also going to be a stunningly cool guest on The Chase, because you're going to get all those.
Only if they ask you about that stuff. There's a lot of
they
things.
Always do. It's always on there. Mm. Once a night, there's a question about, you know, Zeus or Poseidon or Achilles or whatever. Mm. Anyway, Odysseus is the journey of the Troy is finished and everything's been disbanded. All the heroes are now traveling home. They've all got stories. Poseidon is annoyed at Odysseus and so decides to send him on a 10-year side trip. And so he's thinking he's going to go home to Penelope, his wife, who has been living in Ithaca, and so I saw the movie The Return with Ralph Fiennes, which has Odysseus washing up at Ithaca 10 years later as an older, battered, traumatized warrior, and having to sort out all the people who are trying to seize the crown, and good movie, lovely movie, but that's at the end. But the Odyssey really takes us through the adventures with, you know, Cyclops, the Lotus Land, you know, where everything is wonderful, six-headed monsters, you know, which Hollywood has just loved, you know. With
Hydra.
Hydra stuff. Storms with, you know, fantastic whirlpools that he's got to sort of get through. Hypnotic sirens who would sing and he had to be lashed to the mast and all that sort of stuff. Seductive sort of witches, Circe, which sounds like something out of Game of Thrones, and jealous goddesses like Calypso who say, like, immortal life, stay with me, you know, and all that sort of stuff. That sort of fantastic, which he actually tells, Odysseus tells those stories as a guest somewhere, and he relates them. But they all make sense, and you can suddenly realize all those Hollywood movies where they took their terrific inspiration. Anyway, we get redemption, the Avenger arrives, terrific book, and they have little charts where you know what the Romans called the gods and what the Greeks did. You have maps of the Mediterranean where everything played out, which makes sense. All of a sudden, it sort of just brings it to life. And it has a little, Odyssey has a great, how the artists of the world have treated the tales and all the great paintings about the various characters. Stunningly good book, and I can see why it's sold out. And, I just do hope it flies in the future.
Yep.
But enough of me for a moment. What have we got over there that's in your...
Well, not a great deal, but I have been in correspondence with my sister Sue, because I wanted to send her a copy of Bold Types for Christmas, because it's got her name in it.
Now, oh, right.
So Bold Types is a book that Deborah Coddington and Jane Usher put together about independent bookshops.
Is Jane the photographer? Or the photos are great.
Yeah. She also did another lovely-looking book called New Zealand Historical Woolsheds.
Yeah.
No, which we sold some of. It's quite expensive. But.
Actually, I meant to get that. Yeah, Jane Usher. Okay, yeah, because that's an excellent photographer, yep.
Yeah.
And you're in it.
I'm in it, yeah. So Deborah sent me an email, said, we're doing this book, do you want to be in it?
Are there any other wire rapper?
Yeah.
Henleys?
David, for sure. The Martinborough Bookshop, obviously, because that's her.
Featherston?
Nothing in Featherston, no. It's all,
but it is world, not world, it's New Zealand wide.
Absolutely.
See, that book appeals to me. I want to know where, you know, when if I go into these towns, that there is actually a notable independent bookshop.
Hmm. yeah, and
so what do you assess the market to be?
Well, I thought the market would be, I don't know how many bookshops are in there, about 60 or something, maybe more. Anyway, I thought there'd be a market of about 60.
That's and their families, and maybe 100.
But it's turned out to be bigger than that, and I guess the people who like to read, they like to support independent bookshops, I think, and it's nice to be able to read a little bit of the background about why they're there, who's running them, how long they've been around.
I've just picked up and glanced at it. It's kind of also keen to study what these booksellers look like. What a cheerful bunch they are, you know.
I've got a lot to be cheerful about. It's a lovely, it is a nice way to make a living, if you could call it a living. But
that is the bigger picture, isn't it? Is that, you know, bookies who choose to actually retail the stuff they love.
But it's also, you know, you spend most days just chatting to people about books. It's a good thing.
And getting paid for it.
Yeah, wow. That's debatable.
No, look, we will actually have a closer look in 2025, actually, when I've actually read it, and we'll have a further discussion, because I'm sure there's points that will come out of it.
Anyway, so I sent Sue a copy for Christmas.
Yes. How did she figure it? Because she was – is there a Waiheke connection, or was it from here?
Oh, well, of course, from here.
Oh, her origin story.
I think the last I was asked to contribute, I think, 300 words, and I think I did 301. Other people didn't seem to pay attention to that rule. But the last little paragraph says something about, you know, because we're sort of talking about Sue and I starting the business, and then the last one is, you know, that Sue's moved overseas to Waiheke, but Elmo's carries on.
Well, anyway. I think it's a great gift to have given your sister. Well done, you.
And as a result of that, I said, well, have you read anything?
What has she got? We always like Sue's notes. Okay.
So we haven't had these for a while. We'll start off with one that you've talked about. William Boyd, Gabriel's Moon.
My book of fiction book of the year.
Yes. I'll read you what she says and you can comment. William Boyd has written 18 novels, including Any Human Heart, one of the best novels of the 20th century. His latest is about Gabriel Dax, travel writer, who is haunted by the memory of his childhood home in flames. He takes up the offer to interview a political figure, Patrice Lumumba, and later finds his interview recording, because he's of the Congo, wasn't he, Lumumba?
He was.
Yeah. Finds his interview recordings throw light on the conspiracy around his overthrow. Gabriel is drawn into Cold War espionage and completes several assignments behind the Iron Curtain, all the while trying to resolve his childhood trauma with a female psychoanalyst. At the same time, his life is increasingly controlled by his MI6 handler, Faith Green, and by the end of the book, one is left with the hope that Boyd continues with his characters in future books. Loved it. Probably my book of 2024.
Sue and I, simpatico. Just like this. We're like that. It was my book of the year too. I thought it was terrific, you know. And I kind of like. She's missing out the Cadiz, you know, kind of stuff there, but it is, just incredibly evocative of that time, you know, and also the Russian sort of growing threat with Cuba is around the thing. But it's more, Gabriel was just such an engaging, he's making it up as you go, but he discovers actually he's very good at this stuff, you know, and he's intuitively getting all the dangers just realized, and so he can just, you know, whereas a lesser agent is going to make mistakes, he somehow just thinks his way out of it. And of course, we as readers are cheering him on all the way, going, good on you. And he's, you know, it's not a Bondy type, you know, type thing. He's just using his sharp sort of just nature to, you know, I'm so glad that she loved it. Okay, what else we got?
Well, Kate Atkinson, Death at the Sign of the Rook. We've talked about that.
This is Brody, isn't it?
Yeah.
she's always been a fan of his.
Yeah. This is, you know, she's a bit.
She's not getting picky, is she?
She can be a bit picky.
Oh, it's No, it's the Lotus Land approach to life. Oh, my goodness.
Anyway, I'll read you what she says. Kate Atkins is an Atkinson, why can't I say that? Is an excellent and innovative writer. Her three novels set in the Second World War, Life After Life, A God in Ruins, and Transcription, that quite hard cases, are well worth reading, and her crime series featuring Jackson Brodie, retired detective turned private investigator, has many devoted followers and was turned into a TV series. Don't think I knew that. Anyway, Death at the Sign of the Rook is the sixth Jackson Brodie story, which finds him in search of two stolen paintings. One, a portrait missing from the Yorkshire village home of an elderly, recently deceased woman, and the other, a valuable Turner missing from the Burton makepiece, the country home of the Milton family, whose declining fortunes have reduced them to hosting murder mystery weekends. In each case, a young female employee is also missing. Most of the action takes place in the middle of a snowstorm in true Agatha Christie fashion. This book contains many of the expected stereotypes, but with a Kate Atkinson twist. The question is whether that is sufficient to meet the reader's expectations. Jackson Brodie is having a bit of a midlife crisis, but still rouses himself enough to solve the mystery.
Well done, Sue.
I think she thinks it might have been slightly formulaic.
Is there a third?
There is. Daniel Silver, A Death in Cornwall. You read Daniel Silver?
I know people who love this guy.
Yeah.
He's our Israeli art agent. I read one and I didn't kick on.
That's the way I couldn't quite get my mind around the colonel and Mossad being an art restorer.
Yeah, that was a stretch. But
maybe too busy out there killing people. Anyway.
Yeah.
Another book about crime and art. Daniel Silver has written several novels featuring Gabriel Allon, art restorer and forger, and one-time officer in Israeli intelligence, who, because of his unique set of skills, is called in to solve serious crimes. When an art history professor is a victim in a series of murders in Cornwall, and I suppose you're one in the series, aren't you, rather than a victim. and a Picasso worth millions has also been stolen, Allon is brought in to solve the mysteries. Silver's books are always enjoyable, and this is a great one for the holidays. Anyone who enjoys Donna Leon's books about her Venetian detective Guido Brunetti will enjoy Daniel Silver. I guess that's right, although.
I know a couple of people who absolutely can't wait for his every year book and rush off and get it. A little bit of going back in time. I've got a book here. Now, how did Time Shelter run with you?
I've never seen that before.
Georgia Gospodinov.
Yeah, not.
Come on.
Not a household name in Carterton.
It's not. Well, that's interesting because it's a standalone book. No, that's a joke. No, I'm kidding you. But all right. This book won the 2023 International Booker. So it's got a bit of cred.
Yes.
It was published in 2022, but somehow won the prize in 2023. Is that how it works?
I don't know.
It takes a year for them to sort of get it out there. It's an interesting. It's the idea is cool, and I'll give you the pitch. Gustine, a psychiatrist, a very enigmatic, flaneur, European type guy, opens a clinic for the past in Zurich. So it has like six or seven floors, and each floor is a decade, and it has rooms all set up absolutely of the time, with all the magazines, the newspapers, the radio shows, the wallpapers, the, you know, like that. And Alzheimer and dementia patients are bought into it and are put into it. Can it help them, you know, in a particular decade and so they don't insert a little bit of their own personal life from their friends and all that sort of stuff. That's the kind of deal. There's healthy people start to actually going, we like coming too. And so, and they start building these clinics, you know, in Germany, and it starts in Zurich, and then they're starting to, it seems to help, you know, Alzheimer's people and the novel. And our guy is telling the story because he's the sort of procurer of stuff for the rooms and the various decades. So he's, and but he's always trying to find Gustin, who's very elusive, but he's always kind of running it all. But, and so, and we're getting little stories of people who are, you know, who suddenly remember stuff and how they remember stuff. So it's all about kind of memory. It gets so interesting that the sort of the EU decides that why not actually allow countries to have a referendum, and they can, the country will go back into the decade that they most made them most happy.
The whole country.
The whole country will vote on it.
So 51% vote for 1930.
And then they then try and recreate the country with the things like that. I mean, that's how the novel is getting, you know. Anyway, what an unusual book. Tiny chapters, very playful but kind of profound. You know, it's kind of like that nice mix of time and memory and the past. You think it makes you think about your everyday life, of the things that you know, resonate with you. He's a bit of a trickster type writer. I kind of, you know, at times you feel like he's messing around with us in a strange way. You never know where the book is actually really heading for. The book was immensely popular in Europe. It's a bit foreboding because, you know, it's all about illusions and fantasy of, you know, and also we get the playing out, you know, a certain president saying, you know, we're going to make America great again. We're going to throw it back into a time when it really had a bit of, you know, and how people play with that idea that things used to be
better
and all that.
Well, they never were.
Yeah, won the International Booker. The $50,000 prize money was shared by Gospodinov, and he gave half the prize money to his translator. It was written actually in Italian, and then, which I thought was a really cool idea, because it's all about the translation.
Well, it must be, because although some Italian words will translate accurately to English, some of them won't. You know, we've got this discussion about what's in the Treaty of Waitangi right now. If you translate something into Maori and then translate it back again, you get three different books.
The weaponizing of nostalgia. I wrote that down because it's sort of saw it somewhere, and it's kind of books in five segments: themes of losing, escaping, the consequences of living in the past. I'm okay with the paces. The characters never develop. There's not a lot of tension, but you are kind of immersed in it. Like, this is kind of like strange, but it's a kind of interesting idea. And it's very cautionary about how we remember the past. And because I wrote down, you know, all my decades of my life, you know, 50 to 60, you know, like that, and started to go, I could go back into. And any book that makes you start doing it, saying, was I really happy from 30 to 40? Was that kind of, or 50, you know, like, and so I was, you know, on a walk, I was starting to puzzle out some of those, what would I pitch on those things?
The only advice I can give you is you should tell Gail now.
And, you know, it does make you think, what are your earliest memories, if you really go back? And what gets blurred?
Everything.
Not a lot of, it's a challenging little book. Our book club have picked it up, and that's why I probably got more to say about it than usual. But Time Shelter, if you want something a little literary and a little different, certainly would be in the pitch for that.
Talking about your book club, you came along to the cafe last Wednesday?
We did, and Deb was there to greet us and look after us. And we had a great attendance. Eh? Everybody, it was 8 of the 9 were there.
Good.
Then they went off and bought stuff.
Good.
Of course, the problem was we'd agreed on our books for next year for 9 months. Mm. After they'd finished being in your bookshop, they wanted to change them all. That's the woman in our group. They're absolutely, us guys were quite resolute, no changing, but, you know, we'll resist that in the next meeting because they'd seen stuff that they suddenly were excited about.
Because I wasn't there.
You weren't there.
I was learning about.
But one book you did have in your bookshop, A Life Less Punishing, by Matt Heath, who you seem to know a little bit about.
Yeah, I do. He was a radio hierarchy.
You didn't say hack, did you?
No, I did, but I didn't mean it like that. He was on Radio Hierarchy for years and is now on, he's Talk ZB in the afternoons, I think.
I didn't know any of that. I don't, you know, because I don't do the radio very much, but I did notice.
I think he's also in the Alternative Commentary Collective.
Broadcaster, he was on the Matt and Jerry show on Radio Hierarchy.
Yeah.
And Jerry being the guy on 7... Tonight at 7, is it?
Jeremy Wiles, yeah.
Yeah. Columnist, 10 years in the New Zealand Herald. In the movie business, has a production company. He's now an author, of course. He's in the music scene. He has a band, the DJ Voodoo. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, he's written a book, which I thought was kind of cool. I noticed you had it in your sort of philosophy self-help, you know, which is exactly where it belongs. And it's a Kiwi version. I've got a couple of these that I've kind of read. David Latithi's strategy.
He's the food banking guy.
But anyway, we'll talk about this one. So what he does, he's picked up a pile of themes. Or he says here, he studied anthropology and philosophy. So this, he said, therefore I left, you know, university with a degree and really was no qualifications at all, which I thought was. So he goes into the entertainment industry, and this is a really fun mix of memories and ideas. So always each chapter, which is on kind of like anger, being scared, lonely, stressed, greedy, bored, grieving, aimless. He tells a particular anecdote from his life, often very funny, and then he contacts, and I reckon it's through his radio shows and all that sort of stuff, or through his column, great thinkers and authors around the world, zooms them up and asks them all the questions. He then captured the answers for his shows, realized, what else can I do with this material, packaged it up so it's like question to, you know, Robert Harris, and there's, he gets the answer underneath. But it's all the interesting people who write these sort of books, or who are, you know, the experts, give their cut in with, you know, with a pithy sort of good idea. So it makes it a good book.
Yes.
It's a very self-deprecating book. Kiwis love that sort of stuff.
Do.
He does. Take the proverbial, and we were like that. And it's Matt acting badly often, which these sort of shock jocks do, I think. And it brings back one's life's own disasters. Then that's the gift. Mm. Any book that makes you think about, I've had a similar experience where this went sideways, or I did the dumb, that was, and all that cringy stuff where we go like, how could I have done that?
Yes.
Comes up. So definitely a good book. And I'll put it back in its little paper bag that Madeline gave me, and I will pass it to you to be returned, and hope you've got one copy, and I hope it sells by Friday. Okay. Now we've got 17, quarter of an hour. What do you got over there?
Not a lot. I bought you a Christmas present.
Oh, the book you talked about?
Yeah. I haven't flicked through.
I'd give you a Florentine, which is what we're giving people for Christmas this year, but I ate it. Doesn't matter. Gail's got some more.
Okay. So, Merry Christmas, Gail.
Look, I am so happy. I've now, because the libraries are closing for 2 weeks or something. So that is a perfect gift.
They shouldn't do that.
No.
If there's one time, they should stay open.
Right. Now,
anyway,
First Things. Yes. By Harry Ricketts. Now, Madeline was going, I love Harry Ricketts. I read all his books and all that. And she then rushed off to find it. Couldn't find it. Went and looked it up. You'd sold them.
Mm.
So how many did you get?
It's
a slim little green cover.
Yeah, 3 or 4. Probably not many.
Yeah. It's why it's on my attention. It's because it got selected in a book club. So we are keen. He was a poet.
Still is, I think.
He is a literary squalor. Squalor.
Yeah. Well, that's what they can
At least I didn't call him a hack. He's a literary scholar. 30 books and many of them about poetry, of course,
yeah. And some about cricket.
I know. And he kind of arrived in Wellington in 1981, retired in 2022. So he's had a 40-ish career at Vic as a professor of English, and he's kind of like known as a Kipling scholar, amongst other things. This book is called First Memories, and it's like the first, and it's got a memoir, the second part of the memoir, Last Things, is coming out next year. So he's probably writing them side by side. I like this book. It made me think, what are the first memories? He was giving, first memory of going hitchhiking. You know, there's a story. Seeing his father angry for the first time. His first poem. First time he got caned. When they used to do that sort of stuff. Dropping acid, you know, doubting God. All just endlessly interesting things. He chronicles his early life. And it's very much typical memoir, fragments of places and people, writers, encounters and interests, and a lot about music. And that's why I think, you know, a lot of people are going to enjoy this book. Because he wasn't just, like, we were looking at the pop music rock scene from afar back here on the other side of the planet. But when you live in England, grow up in England, these bands were there and they were down in London where you could get to them. And so that was fascinating. You know, we're getting into all that. The book is like a good dinner or cafe encounter, engaging. The man is so well-read, politically aware, entertaining, and a little unsettling in places, which is... And every now and then there's a poem that kind of illustrates something. He's just slots in something from his vast lifetime of writing poetry. Four sections is the preschool and primary school years, which are kind of fun to, and it brings back your own kind of primary school days. Secondary school, which is Wellington College in England, then Oxford, and then the last section is taking his first job as a sort of junior lecturer in Hong Kong. And he leaves, that's the end of the book, and then he's going to leave Hong Kong and come to New Zealand. There's his life, his sporting life in cricket is well documented through the school magazines, I feel. Funny, if you're a cricket fan, or, you know, and cricket writing is always, I reckon, it's such a sort of...
People have time to...
be funny and reflective, because there is time. Your own when you read this, it's one of the like a best of memoirs. Your own experiences come flooding back, which is always the cricket bits are great. Handling relationships and sex, that is just candid, and that also brings back memories. And Orwell said, autobiography is only to be trusted when it reveals something disgraceful. And I suddenly thought, that is so good. And we've got it there. And he tells us about an affair that went seriously wrong. And it is just laid out, you know, but you do get the feeling that this is, you know, as it is. And that's the little unsettling bits that are tucked away in it. The guy is really well read. He could be sitting here and he could
He would know stuff that we don't.
He would know in spades. I mean, I go, I think I've read a bit of my life, and I'm going like, what? You know, but he's read a lot of the books that you and I will have read, because we're of an age. Well, I'm more of an age, but and it's love the education. What a UK education and a Kiwi education is all there. A lot about Dylan and but it's the writing, prof of English, clear, tight, to dream, to read. It sort of sounds nice in your head, you know, that sort of writing. Good, you know, terrific New Zealand memoir or autobiography memoir, and I would totally commend it. We're rocketing down the last few minutes, and David, Neithe,
I don't know.
David,
yes.
Has written a book, a New Zealand book. He lives in Auckland, so let's put him in New Zealand, called The Winning
Mindset. New Zealand.
Yeah, The Winning Mindset. The Successful Strategizing for Sport, Business and Life.
So who was this guy? What gives him the right?
Good question. Because Lydia Ko and Mr. Alessania?
Israel Alexander.
Alexander, are on the cover saying, this guy helped us.
Okay.
And also the Breakers coach was saying, you know, he helped us win championships and all that.
Should do that again then.
Well, as we lose seven in a row, you know, and are plunging out of the standings, doesn't matter. Our confidence will come back. These things happen in sport. We will win again. In fact, we won't get into that. Yeah, he's a mental guy.
Got a bit depressing though, didn't it, with the Phoenix losing and the cricketers getting smashed and the Breakers not.
It's just another week in sport. Doesn't matter because there's another game on the horizon.
Yeah, that's right.
But this is a book about the mental side of it all, and it's kind of like, which we acknowledge is really, really important, but somebody who's making a life study of it and working with these people and working with successful New Zealand athletes is worth, I think, you know, the book is, it's a really good book. It's a book that I think any sports-minded teenager or in a school library or any aspiring athlete should jump into. It's kind of like, it's not all of all that, you've got to have, having all that talent, if you don't have the mind bit worked out, it's not going to happen.
There's a question on The Chase the other night about, it said, what percentage of footballers who go into the professional academies for the, you know, the professional league teams actually ever get on the pitch? And the answer was 3%. And the chaser said, if 1% had been there, I would have gone for that. So all these kids who have been sorted out as being...
The pyramid is wide.
Yeah.
The pinnacle is tiny.
Yeah, and they all started off with talent.
Yeah.
So what determines...
Yeah, he's into just a fearless mentality for a start, that you really got to get into that fearlessness, not fearing stuff, which probably has a lot to do with Israel Alexander, where you're absolutely facing it. But and he gets you to reframe failure so that becomes in a better way. It's good about anything that's self-limiting. He kind of identifies and gets that, moves that away. About creating the self-image about yourself that's incredibly confident. It's performing without fear, the best version, of course. If it's going to take if it's going to take me to the top, it's up to me. And start with the end in mind, always about always keeping that, letting go of outcomes and just being in the intention of what you're intending to do in this particular event. So every event, there's intentions of what's happening here. So the outcome is not important. It's like, what are we moving in this particular moment? Pain is unavoidable, but it's almost about designing your life, not letting life just unfold and letting others. It's actually going, these, you know, and that life design is actually quite an interesting idea, to say how much of our life are we designing and how much was it just pure fate, you know, chance encounters that took us places.
What do they say, you know, the harder you work, the luckier you get?
David's good at this. Great profiles to illustrate his ideas. I think coaches would love a book like this, because often it's not about the running the drills. It's actually changing the athletes that you've got with you. And so you're running the things, and often coaches stop there. They're really good at running, and I can ascribe to this. You get good at running systems, you forget about the individuals there. You're more like, you got this big picture. But in fact, it's me talking to Steve about your performance within the big team concept and getting you in this moment, what are we actually... And, the top 2 inches...
See, it is interesting, just talking about Lydia Ko.
Yes.
You know, she was basically in competition with a Swiss woman for the gold medal, and there was never any doubt in my mind that she would win because she wanted to.
Well, yeah, and golf, I mean, what a mind game that is. a little thing like spoken words, the tone of your voice is about 7% of the effectiveness, or your spoken words is, 7%, your tone of how you speak is about 38%, but your body language is everything. And he was talking about, athletes speaking and all that. It's a confidence you...
It's the same for sure with salespeople.
On that note, we now reach the end of another year of Book Lovers Wairarapa. Yeah. Any idea on your book of the year? I mean, Sue and I have got our one out there.
No, not really.
You have too many books circling around, so we'll forgive you that. But hey, look, another fantastic year. We look forward to being with you in 2025. The Elmos is thriving. They have a wide and inviting collection of books for you to see before Christmas.
And now we're starting to sell a few. You can actually see some of the others. They did get a bit jumbled up.
So do call into Elmo's and see the team. They'll find a book for you. And we'll find books for you next year. So we look forward to catching up with you in January. And so thank you. And you can find material on the Elmo's book Facebook page.
Yep.
And we look forward to catching up with you on the end of January.
Yep.
Any final words?
Thank you very much, Gareth, for your sterling work during the year.
Been a pleasure.